Hello, everyone. This is JVL here with my best friends, Sarah Longwell and Tim Miller of The Bulwark. We got a full docket today. We had another primary in Ohio, the Buckeye State. We haven't gotten together, the three of us, to talk about the American bloodbath that's coming and Trump taking aim at Cassidy Hutchinson. And then I am on fire about Judge Eileen Cannon. We'll save that for the third so that my hate fire can build over the course of these 3 hours. All right. I'll just set the table right now. Last night, we thought that maybe the normie Republican, Matt Dolan, might have had a chance against Bernie Moreno, who is a terrible candidate in Ohio. He just owns a car dealership and does a little crypto and, you know, is the kind of guy who has interns who think it would be a fun prank to set up adult friend finder profiles of him, which is a totally normal thing that all of us who have had interns have had happen. He won by 18.
Yeah,
he won by 18.
Guys, can I just tell you how implausible this is? I have a room of young people who are my colleagues and who work with me, but I am their boss. The idea that one of them would go into one of my accounts, my work account, and create any kind of dating profile, searching, like, first of all, they'd know if they, like, they'd never find their bodies if they did that. But, like, more important, like, they just wouldn't. It would never occur to them.
They might do it to Barry. For people who haven't read, people should know what they're talking about. Go look at the Mark Caputo did a very wonderful breakdown of this weird story where this intern signed up a adult friend or finder account where Bernie Moreno was looking for young men. But, like, yeah, so exactly. A prank, okay, it's a prank. It's like your direct boss, maybe. You're pranking them. It's April Fool's Day. For an intern to do this to the head of the car dealership.
Also, it's not clear that there's any records that he actually interned there. Living 3 hours away from the dealership when he claimed to be an intern.
Yeah, and they're like, the car dealership asked for needed interns to review emails. It's like, what? You're having a college kid 3 hours away? The whole thing is preposterous.
And also, we don't care that Bernie Moreno.
I mean, every office has a different culture, Sarah.
It would be great.
No.
I mean, the stuff I did to Bill Kristol as pranks when I was his staff assistant back at the Weekly Standard.
Oh, yeah?
I signed him up on FetLife. There's a whole FetLife profile about Bill Kristol where he's really into, like, Jane Austen kinks. And anyway, I don't want to get too into it, but... there was also a little Greek tragedy stuff happened
there.
Oh, it's
there,
so funny.
Know
what I mean? Greek
Bill's
tragedy.
Newsletter now. It's just there's so many more quotations from
the little
from
green
the Greeks.
Books. Yeah.
I will say, too, Sarah's trying to get at this about the fact that this gay thing, obviously on this podcast, we don't care that it's gay. I do think that it's funny that the last gasp, like I was trying, like had Dolan won today, it would have been like, well, man, the last two times that the normie Republicans had successfully taken out a MAGA, it was through gay baiting. It's like Madison Cawthorn is like the one example of somebody they successfully took out. And it's like, oh, well, thank goodness we have the normies to do the gay baiting. So anyway, we've lost the host job. We ripped it from you. Maybe you should share the results with the people, JVL.
So here's the thing. Matt Dolan combined with Frank LaRose for 48.5 points put together. Even if it hadn't been a divided field, and even if all of Frank LaRose's votes had gone to Matt Dolan, which they wouldn't have, Moreno went over 50. He went over 50%.
And he won every county.
He won every county, and he did better than he had done in any polling. A case could be made, correlation is not causation, that the scandal helped him?
I don't think so. Here's what I think really happened and why I never... Look, I went on MSNBC yesterday at 4 o'clock before the polls closed, and I gave a full-throated endorsement of Matt Dolan, who I disagree with on a lot of things, who seems like he's way too conservative for a moderate squish like me, but who did the right thing about 2020. And it's like better to have him than a Trump toady, phony insurrectionist who like is totally full of shit and is going to do whatever Donald Trump says because he's his butt boy. Now, absolutely, Matt Dolan was a better choice. So I did my part. The one MSNBC viewer who is undecided with 2 hours left in the polls, hopefully I pushed them in the right direction. But here's the thing. I always knew it was going to be Moreno because these primary polls had these huge undecideds. And because of Sarah's focus groups, because we've lived through this and these other primaries, we just know what the share of the vote is. You know, there's maybe 30% of the party, best case, that wants somebody that is not part of the Trump cult at best. And maybe if that person runs a really great campaign and is very compelling, they can eke it out to 34 or 35. And if that person like kind of lies and pretends like he's Trumpy, maybe you can get up to 30. But like, that's just it. And so when these polls were coming out, it was like Moreno 33, Dolan 30, LaRose 18, you know, undecided 15. I was like, oh yeah, those undecideds are going to Moreno. Like the people that were undecided were MAGA undecided that were still trying to decide, what do I think? Do I want, which phony MAGA do I want more? Do I care that this guy maybe had a secret gay account? Right, like those were the undecideds. They were decided that they were MAGA. And anybody that just like really honestly looked at it kind of saw that. I was surprised it was an 18-point win. I was thinking it'd be more like 10, but... Yeah, that's just the state of the party. It's just where the party is.
Did you listen to this week's focus group podcast?
With Henry Gomez?
Yeah.
I did.
I listened to the first half. I didn't finish it. I'm sorry.
Well, if you listen to it, you would, like, they were all Moreno. Yeah. There was, like, we did two Ohio groups. One was all Moreno, and the other one was just, like, kind of low info, hadn't really made up their minds yet, right? It was these groups, but they were, like, plenty MAGA, and there was only sort of one Dolan voter in the whole bunch. And this guy was just one of us. He was just like, he didn't want to vote for Trump and he liked Dolan. And like, he was sounded exactly like you would expect, a suburban voter. But the rest of them, like, they were either super pro Bernie Moreno or, and I even like, I pressed Henry Gomez. And like, the one thing he said is that Dolan was just on the air everywhere. But if you listen to the voters, what they knew about Dolan, the one thing they knew was that he had changed the name of the Cleveland Indians to the Cleveland Guardians.
Woke.
And I was like, woke, it caved to the woke mob. So woke. The one scenario I could have seen, right, in these races where you have sort of a mega MAGA, a mini MAGA, and a non-MAGA, which is what we had, I wondered about, you'd have to get the perfect split. Like, LaRose and Moreno needed to be, like, sort of perfectly splitting the vote. And then Dolan had to be able to, like, sneak through with, like, an extra decimal point.
32, 32, 36, right?
Yeah, or something like that. 34, 33. But, like, so I thought that was, like, maybe Dolan's one shot. But there weren't enough LaRose people in the groups. Like, they were Moreno people. And half of what they knew about him was that Trump had endorsed him. And so... I think it's important to know, too, what's happening.
Do you explore the Indians issue with them a little bit? I mean, I just wonder what was so... I like, you know, how these people would have felt maybe if, like, a black team owner, like, created a baseball team that had... And they were, like, the Crackers. And
their black mascot professional was, sports team over?
Yeah,
team
their over, mascot team was, like, a guy that was missing some teeth and that had a T-shirt with a racial slur on it. I wonder how they would have felt about that.
I don't know. Well, here's what I will say that... That people did unpack it. So this must have been quite the conversation in Ohio when the change was being thought about. It's sort of like what the Redskins conversation was here when they were changing the name. Like, it was a debate that people had. And one of the women I remember was talking about the fact that at the time there were a number of Native Americans who came out in defense of the Cleveland Indians, saying that it was sort of honoring their heritage. And I'm just telling you what I heard the voters say. And so they were, that was the big betrayal though. Like, that was what they knew about the whole thing. And I was pretty skeptical with that being the most top of mind thing for these voters
So they were worried that if he had gone to the United States Senate, he would have changed America's mascot from
the bald eagle
to a trans woman or something. Yeah. Like, I don't know.
Maybe a cat person.
But, sure. You know, they really...
Yeah, it's not like we have alternate flags and national anthems now for people who attack the Capitol. So
I have a question for you. And I know you have more to say, Sarah, but I want to get this in before you bring it up yourself. 161,000 Ohioans voted for Nikki Haley, even though she's not in the race anymore. And it's not really a closed primary in Ohio, but it's not really an open primary either. You can go up and ask for any ballot, but if you register, you're stuck with that party for 2 years. That seems like a lot of people.
So I'm glad you brought this up. I was going to bring this up, although I wasn't going to do it about Ohio. I was going to do it about Arizona.
Okay.
Do you know off the top of your head what percentage she got in Ohio?
I have it up on one another tab. You keep talking.
I will tell you that with 80% of the votes in right now in Arizona, Nikki Haley has gotten 108,108 votes, which is 18.7% of the electorate.
She's at 14.4% in Ohio.
14.4%, huh?
The Serbians did it.
And then, I mean, Ron DeSantis came in under 10,000, but still, between the two of them, there's almost 20%. And what's interesting to me, right, is that this is when she's not on the ballot, right? She was getting 30% from self-ID'd Republicans when she was on the ballot.
Super Tuesday, she did not get 30%.
You're
Super
right. Tuesday. No, you're right. You're right. But in places...
When
sorry,
she was campaigning.
In places where she was campaigning, yeah, where you were putting together the anti-Trump coalition, right? And I'm talking about self-ID'd Republicans. I'm not talking about the whatever 40% she got in New Hampshire, where there was a lot of independents. I'm talking about the self-ID'd Republicans. And so it's interesting that when she's not even on the ballot, there's still people who are just like, I am going to go out and vote against Trump. And here's the thing is that it's not actually, the percentage matters, but what matters more is the enthusiasm. The enthusiasm, the interest in going out to specifically vote against Donald Trump, right? There's no race. You're just like, I'm going to take time out of my night. And it's not going to win anything. This person's not even campaigning, not even on the ballot. But I'm just going to go say, I hate this guy. I don't want him to be the nominee. I do feel like, see, here's the thing. Ohio, it doesn't matter. Ohio is gone. The fact that it went for Obama twice. Yeah, it went for Obama twice. But like Tim Ryan was a perfectly acceptable normie candidate. And it's now, this does get to the Sherrod Brown of it all, which I think like any Democrat will tell you, there's only one Democrat who can win in Ohio still. And that's Sherrod Brown, this incumbent that people like. And against Moreno, who, you know, Moreno will have a tough time getting the Matt Dolan voters. A lot of those Matt Dolan voters may well vote for Sherrod Brown. Although it's a weird, this one's like a weirdo race because Sherrod's more of a populist.
If you wouldn't mind, can we just put a pin in Sherrod and come back to it? Because I want to address the Nikki Haley part of this first. Because I have a little bit of a different view. No, you don't apologize. It's good. I want to be able to hit both of them because they're both important questions. And like on the Nikki Haley thing, I just am a little bit of a Debbie Downer on this. Everybody wants to be very happy about this number. And so I want to be happy. I want to say I also want to be happy. I hope it's a good sign. But I want to give the Debbie Downer view on this, which is that, like, I think it's similar to the special elections. It's like there is a group of never Trumpers of us, of our people, maybe they're listening, right? Red dogs who like fucking hate Donald Trump so much. And they hate him more than anything. And I love them for it, you know, and they're moms. There's some people in my life that are like this. And they're like, every policy issue I care about is dwarfed by my loathing of Donald Trump. And I loathe him so much. I'm going to leave the Republican Party. I'm going to vote for Democrats. I'm going to show up for my state legislature special election. And I'm also going to show up on the Republican because I left the party Republican Party in my head, but I never really re-registered. So I'm going to show up today after school pickup and I'm going to stick it to them because it makes me feel good. And God bless all those people.
So people like, with TDS.
Yeah. But are they the voters Biden needs? I guess Biden needs to keep them. So it's
keep
good
them,
in that
for sure.
sense that he hasn't lost them. It's good in that sense that he hasn't lost them. But I don't, you know, some people look at that number and they're like, wow, that means 18% of Republicans voted or 14.4% of Republicans are open for Biden now. And it's kind of like, well, actually, I bet of that 14.4%, I bet 8 or 9% of those people are the people we're talking about that were already voted for Biden and fucking hate Trump and are as much more Democrat than Rashida Tlaib is a Democrat, right? At this point. And so in practical matters. So I wish we could see a better breakdown of these numbers to make me feel a little bit better about what's cut of them out or voted for Trump last time.
So this is the number, right? The number was in 2020, I think, Trump lost 8% of Republicans. And of this 14%, you have to assume that at least 8% of them are going to swing to Biden. But if it's 9%, and that plays out nationally, that's a very meaningful number.
Not nationally. If it plays out in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Arizona. It's the reason I cared much more about Nikki Haley's percentage in Arizona than I did in Ohio, because Ohio's gone and it's not coming back. Arizona, to have 18%, almost 20% combined, show up to not vote for Trump, like, And again, Tim, I hear you. And I'm nervous about all these numbers. And I'm nervous about letting it make us feel too good. But
Don't worry about that, Sarah, because none of us are going to feel good until after the election.
But that idea, the people that are going to turn out to stick it to Trump, like the worst case scenario is that people aren't feeling like that, right? The worst case scenario is that people are like, and they just are like, Trump's already won this, why bother? But the fact that they want to take time out of their day just to go vote against him in a race that nobody can possibly win, where the candidate's not even running, that feels like lurking under all the numbers. People who are like, give me a chance to go mess this guy up and I'm going to take it. And not an insignificant percentage. That's good.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's good. That's encouraging. There's a little... You know how sometimes I need to put a damper on happy talk. Rain cloud needs to put a damper on hate. And a lot of my, and I feel like I should, because all of my like social media friends who I usually agree with on everything are like posting like, hell yeah, 20% for Nikki Haley is a great sign. And I'm looking at them kind of like, is it a good sign? I think so. Maybe it might be. I'm not sure. So anyway, I interrupted you. I do want to get into the, because I think the Sherrod Bernie race is super interesting, and I would like to go back to that, but I just wanted to explore the Nikki thing first. So where do you remember where you were on that?
Well, I don't know where I was, but I guess I would just say as an opening gambit on, like, the Dems wanted Bernie Moreno, right? They were doing that thing that I hate that they do, where they were spending money to be like, this guy's the guy
Trump
loves.
Ultimately, it didn't matter.
It didn't matter, so which is like, why do it?
It doesn't matter. Yeah.
So why do it?
That is, so why do it? Yeah.
So why lose the moral high ground? And why waste your money when, you know, it's a Trump cult. They're going to nominate the Trump freak. You don't have to worry about it.
These guys all think they're so clever doing this. Like, knock it off. Like, the Republican Party's plenty bad. They will do the job for you. You don't need to help.
Or fake it a little more. I don't know. Find some rich person, donor to, like, you know, some, you know, to put it under something. At least be clever, you know, come on.
No, well, these were clever. I mean, these were ads saying, this guy's way too conservative.
I know.
Now, effectively, like, they weren't shining him up. Generous read is they were preparing the battlefield for the general election.
Uh-huh. I don't believe that generous. I'm just saying. Anywho, go ahead.
Share it.
That's fine. Only that I think, you know, this is going to be the toughest of the races. I mean, they're all going to be tough. Senate race. Yeah, Tester's going to be hard too. Like, it's just a question of, like, can Democrats still win in these red states when they're incumbents? And, like, Sherrod Brown's the only Democrat who can win in Ohio these days. And can he still win? I'm not sure he can.
Yeah, JVL's shaking his head. Here's the problem for Sherrod is, like, it worked for Fetterman. And Pennsylvania is a much better state. But you're basing it on this model, right, where it's like you can overperform in the rurals and in the small towns and the Toledos because you are more economically populist and authentically so, and at least some percentage of the voters do not believe that you have been co-opted by the woke left, right? Like, so that's part of your gambit. But the other part is you also have to win the Dolan voters, for whom Sherrod Brown is, like, not the ideal Democrat at all, right? And so you have to convince them that Bernie Moreno is so unacceptable.
You mentioned this for a second before about how he's more populist. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think that Sherrod has very smartly kind of resisted from a positioning standpoint, you know, going in on the Democratic identity stuff and has focused more on economic issues, pro-union issues. He's more protectionist. Tammy Baldwin's done a little bit of this on the edges when it comes to, like, working with J.D. Vance on random, you know, train safety. And, I'd have to go look at the list of the things that Sherrod Brown has worked with people on. So, like, he's worked hard to cultivate that image.
But do you think that doesn't help him with Dolan voters?
I mean, he's working hard to cultivate that image to reach the Obama-Trump voters, right? In order to win Ohio, you need to swamp. You need to run huge numbers up with Obama-Trump voters and with Romney-Clinton voters, right? Like, these rural working-class whites that used to be Democrats that now became Republicans, and the upscale whites that, let's just be honest, we're mostly talking about white people, that used to be Republicans and now are more Democrat. Like, you need to do well with both really, really well. I just think that's a tough combo for anybody. And Fetterman managed to pull it off, but he had the benefit of, he's on the ballot with Shapiro in a midterm, as Sebastian points out. you know, with on a ballot with Shapiro, where Shapiro was kind of helping with that crowd, right? And Sherrod is going to be on a ballot with Trump in a presidential year. I think it's tough.
So let me ask you guys something. One of the things that has really helped the Republican Party since 2016 is the phenomenon of Trump running behind down ballot Republicans. So you put Trump on the ballot at the top of the ticket. He brings out all of these people who don't vote otherwise. They vote for Trump. Your normie Republicans who really don't like Trump come out because they always come out. And some percentage of them won't vote for Trump. They'll go for Hillary or they'll go for Biden. But down ballot, they'll stick with all the normie senators.
Who aren't so normie anymore. But well, this is directionally true.
But this is what I was going to say. So what happens to that equation when Republicans aren't running, when they're just running Trump up and down the ballot?
We have an example of this that's bad news, kind of, which is Ron Johnson.
Yeah, right? But he just changed. He wasn't a new guy.
Yeah, that's true. In 16, I guess, he wasn't quite as Trumpy. But like you were seeing that. But he was 1622, so he wasn't on the 2020 ballot. I'm trying to think if there was a 2020 example of this, of a Trumpy Senate candidate.
I don't think we have one, really, because the same thing happened in 2020, right? Republicans overperformed down ballot than what you would have expected them to. And I don't know, like maybe, you know, some percentage of people are just going to stay with the tribal identity and we'll suck it up and vote for the down ballot. But some percentage aren't, I think. I think this is the dark side of that trade that the Republicans have been making, right? Where they thought, well, we need Trump because without him, we can't reach those low propensity voters. But with him, even though we turn off some of our people, we really hold on to a bunch anyway. Once the whole party is Trump, then you're wedded to those low propensity voters and you're going to start shedding more of the red dogs, right?
I'm looking at the list. There really isn't a good example in 2020. Yeah. All the 2020 candidates were much less Trumpy than Moreno. Like Perdue and Loeffler, I guess, is the closest example. But they're really, yeah, that's interesting. That's a good point.
All right, so moving on. Donald Trump, who is known for always choosing his words carefully and being very into norms and decorum and who has never dabbled in allusions to political violence before, was treated very unfairly this weekend by the mainstream, lamestream news media, who, when he said there would be a bloodbath if Joe Biden was elected president, if you read the context and just sort of treat what you know about him and his history, it's clear that he's referring to there would be a bloodbath for the domestic auto industry. And I mean, he didn't say that explicitly, but anyway, it's just, you know, it's one more reason. This is why I have to vote for Trump, Sarah. This is why I didn't want to. I didn't want to.
You are okay. So your position is, and Tim's, is that you think that it was fine the way that those clips about bloodbath were clipped and disseminated.
I would say they were neither fine nor not fine.
Okay, so I have really strong feelings about this, and I'm gonna
hear them.
So I thought, and the reason I want to talk about it, even though it's Wednesday now and this happened this weekend, is that we cannot do this race. JVL, you talk about the asymmetry of expectations and how unfair it is all the time. It is unfair. It is also the world that we live in. Donald Trump, through the course of that, Bernie Moreno, he was in Ohio giving a speech, said so many insane things. He did a pledge of allegiance to the great January 6th hostages and listened to their national anthem, an alternative national anthem for the people who stormed the Capitol. I believe it was in this same speech where he talked about Joe Biden was losing to Barack Hussein Obama. There was any number of things that you could pull from that speech. Now, when I saw the bloodbath comments, I retweeted them. I commented about them and then went and listened to the whole thing. And the second I listened to the whole thing, I immediately deleted what I had posted because to me, it's not even close. And the thing that drives me crazy or that I think is really bad and that we should avoid, because right now there's going to be a bunch of people listening to me being like, Sarah, they're going to take what you just said, JVL, which is like, we know the whole context. We know how he uses violent language. Sure. Okay. I heard Joe Biden one time say that Mitt Romney wanted to put black people back in chains. And this is not me both sides saying, this is me saying, we do not get to selectively clip. He was absolutely talking about the auto industry. And that one line where he was like, just listen to it. Did you read it or did you go listen to it?
Yeah, no, probably. I read it. I read the whole thing on the podcast the other day.
Did you listen to it?
Yeah, I watched it. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And you think that there is even a scintilla of doubt that he was on a riff. He was on like a long riff about the auto industry and tariffs. And then he says, if Joe Biden gets elected, it'll be a bloodbath. Right after talking about it.
That'll be the least of your problems. That'll be the least of the problems, the bloodbath.
That'll be the least of it. But that's what is he talking about? It is not at all clear.
Okay, there we go. We agree. It's not clear that he's talking about the auto industry.
I think it is clear. I'm saying it's not at all clear that he's talking about anything but that. In the context of what he was saying, it felt completely to me like he was talking about there's going to be a bloodbath. And he was talking about economic things. Like, and here's the point. Let's say we sort of disagree on this, okay? And that there's like, he's mostly in the context of the auto industry, but there's this line that you could pull out to be like, this is like a, but don't you, Sarah, don't you think this line is weird? Okay. We are now parsing these weird things that he said instead of talking about the things that were flagrantly crazy and insane. And instead it looks like the entire discourse now is about the way that Trump is treated unfairly, the fact that he was taken out of context. And to me, my gut level instinct when I listened to the whole thing was this was absolutely out of context. And it's not just the way that they were cut and disseminated on the internet was out of context.
All right. I don't necessarily disagree with that. But here's the problem, which is, can somebody, me and Susan Glasser talked about this in the main pod. Does anybody have a solution? Maybe JVL does. JVL's always got the big ideas. What is the solution to this? Because Donald Trump, every time he speaks, it is just like a river of non sequiturs and lies and conspiracies and bullshit. And like that is his all of his entire speeches. And the media is still trapped. And this is a fair criticism of the mainstream media, that they are still trapped in the 2012 Mitt Romney frame of, oh, we got to do a gotcha. Like, gotcha, Mitt Romney, you slipped and said binders full of women. That's a story. I gotcha, Joe Biden, you slipped and said Mitt Romney's going to put people back in chains. And like, that's how political media was for my whole life. Right? It was this, I was part of it. I was the one that was feeding the gotchas to the reporters. Be like, look at this slip that Obama just had. Like you got to, so that's how they're covering this. And sometimes it's stupid. Gotcha journalism was always stupid. So sometimes Donald Trump is a victim of this, just like Joe Biden is sometimes a victim of this, where, you know, where the media or cable obsesses over some like snippet that isn't exactly what they meant to say. And that's gaffe coverage and that's stupid. But like, how do you do? But then when somebody comes to me and their next sentence is, oh, well, Donald Trump is treated unfairly. That's what I'm like, no. Donald Trump gets the best treatment of any politician in history by the media. And everybody, MAGA people come and get so mad at me, and National Review people be so mad at me for saying that. But that is true. Because like, if somebody is every day is lying and smearing people and threatening to overturn the democracy, then really, if we're being fair, every day, the front page of the New York Times and the first story on ABC News should be, mm-hmm. Donald Trump lied again today. Donald Trump threatened to overthrow our democracy again today. And if that happened, then everybody would be like, oh, look how bad. The media is just the DNC. The media is doing the DNC. Well, I'm sorry. If you nominate a person that fucking lies and that tries to that incited a storming of the Capitol, then that's going to be the news every day. Like, that was your fault. You have responsibility.
This is exactly my point, though. They should be doing that, right? Mike Pence isn't going to endorse Donald Trump. He won't vote for Donald Trump. The guy's vice president. It's like a one-day story, two-day story, and it's over. Yeah. There was a fire hose of falsehoods in that. Why grab the one thing that was like not the most offensive thing? Because it looked like it. I'm sorry. We have to be better. These are gimmies to the other side. These are gimmies to the other side. We have to be better and locked up in our messaging and make sure that we are hitting him on things he actually said, not things that they're able to skate around on. That was an easy one to skate around on.
So the question then is, who is we? And
no, but the media is absolutely ignoring everything right now. They're not covering any of the crazy things that he's saying. And instead, now we have bloodbath discourse.
I feel like the bloodbath discourse, at least in the mainstream sort of bubbles I float around in, has been a lot of self-flagellation and people saying kind of what you just did, which is, again, proving why those people, including you, Sarah, are the good guys.
Andrew Egger and I were talking about this because he had sort of an anti, like he was doing the anti-backlash. And I just was like, who did I see? I saw maybe it was Ian Bremmer. Like there's sort of one other person and I felt the exact same way as him. He was just like, just listen to it. It's plain as day. The guy's in the middle of a long riff about the auto industry.
Most of the discourse has been where you are.
I don't think so. I mean, people were telling me to delete my tweet when I was like, we shouldn't do this.
Well, you're on Twitter. That's a mistake.
Yeah, but okay, fine. it's a little bit, I'm sorry. And these are going to tie them to things that sound unrelated, but to me, they are related. It is Fonnie Willis. It is every unforced error that is going to make up the totality of this campaign. And it is deeply frustrating. Like a lot of the things that I saw defending this is like, well, but the media, you know, never talks about this. So fine, let's tell them to talk about this. Put on the front page that he played an alternate national anthem and is celebrating the January 6th insurrectionists and calling them hostages. We should have a lot of discourse about that. Don't take the one other thing where, like, frankly, I don't even think it's up for debate what he was talking about, but like it's at minimum deeply debatable and sure. So many other things aren't.
Sure. The problem, Sarah, is that, I mean, this machine that is the pro-democracy coalition is so big and has so many moving parts that there is no, I mean, they're just going to be fuck-ups, right? They're going to be Fonnie Willis's who make bad decisions. They're going to be, you know, five reporters from your headline writers at various mainstream publications who do suboptimal things like this. Because there is no command and control structure. It's just, you know, it's 80 million people trying to save America, all doing their own thing. And I guess I'm a little more sublime that like these things are going to happen. And there is nothing we can do to prevent them from happening. And the fact that our side tries to self-correct and tries to be honest about this is why we can look around and say we're not the baddies, right? Because that doesn't happen on the other side. No, nobody at Breitbart ever is like, boy, were we unfair to Cassidy Hutchinson? Like that doesn't happen on that side.
I'm also genuinely, like, this is a genuine question. So I guess maybe the answer is it's just unfair. But like, there was an entire impeachment ecosystem of the current president, an entire media ecosystem on the right supporting a totally fraudulent impeachment based on made up shit. There's no, oh, woe is me. Like, oh, did we take Hunter a little out of context? Did we take Joe out of context? There's no panel. Brett Baer's panel isn't contemplating whether James Comer is maybe victimizing Joe Biden and how Joe Biden is a victim of unfair attacks. I just like, okay, I hear you. Like, I hear you. Like, it was like some of those headlines were wrong about it.
Here's what I care about. I care about giving them an excuse to dismiss the legitimate criticisms. Like, I'm sorry that we have to be so much better than the other side. Like, to me, the least compelling arguments are the ones about how the right-wing media and MAGA voters behave, because we've got a very specific task in front of us, which is to get to these people who get turned off by Trump, but also get turned off to the what they think is overheated or unfair or, you know, sort of smearing of Trump. It's just too much. And maybe it's because I listen to the voters and I hear it all the time, but like I could hear the second it happened that they were going to win, that the bloodbath discourse was going to be won by people who say, see what they do to Trump, see how they take him out of context. And to me, just being like a regular person who hates Trump, but who can listen to the context of something, I was like, this is out of context. And this is going to hurt us more than it's going to help us. And we should be focusing on the things that he does say. And I think that it's eight months out. We
have
got to get people.
One genuine question for you, actually, though, with the voters.
Okay.
How do you get those voters to be more upset or to be equally upset that the Republicans have fabricated a smear about corrupt Joe Biden that was planted maybe by a Russian stooge and held hundreds of hearings about it, hundreds of hours of hearings about it, and that Joe Biden and his family have been victimized by these lies. How do you get them to when you're in a focus group, say that rather than, oh, poor Donnie Trump was smeared again because they said that he meant a bloodbath when he kind of didn't really mean a bloodbath? Like, I don't know the answer to that. It's like, if all we're doing is self-flagellating all the time, isn't that giving them, you know what I mean? Like, how do you break through?
Okay. Do you know what the number one indicator is of a voter who is persuadable, especially on things like, I don't think the election was stolen, like, I might vote for Joe Biden. Like, what do you think the number one thing is that we that helps us know whether or not they are reachable and persuadable?
I would assume it is they don't think the election was stolen. Or do you mean a different kind of demographic marker?
Sorry, I don't mean to ask you guys a question like we're in a class. Okay, I'll just the thing that happens is college education, whatever. The number one thing is that they have a media mix that includes like local TV or CNN. They also watch Fox, right? So like, but they've got a media mix, and so they're the noise, right? So much of politics is like, how do you turn the volume up on certain narratives so that things break through? And it's wild to see what breaks through and what doesn't, what lives in a DC bubble and what doesn't, what people are. Do you know right now there are evangelicals all over this country who have no idea that Mike Pence will not vote for Donald Trump, will not endorse Donald Trump? Because the volume's not very high on it. It's like the entire press corps.
Did you see the thing about the Fox News number of minutes that was spent on this? It was hilarious. It was like, it happened on Fox News. The interview happened on Fox News. And it was like in the 24 hours after that, it was like 100 minutes were spent on this on CNN. 3 minutes were spent on Fox.
That's right.
So Fox didn't even cover the news that broke on their network about Mike Pence not endorsing Donald Trump.
That's exactly right. And so they're running a smear like, we are not talking about the things that matter. And I think that the media, this is one of those, we're always fighting the last war. The media, whatever that is, right? But like this big amorphous blob got the message loud and clear that they were somehow like promoting. I think there's a few things going on, but one of them was they were giving him too much airtime for all of his misinformation. And so now nobody carries his things live. And as a result, people don't watch them. They get them from these clips that go viral on the internet, right? We're not seeing how much he's disintegrated. Like he was always nuts, but like, he is saying even more insane things. He has lost a step, and people aren't seeing it nearly as much. And so we have got to turn the volume up, not on what Republicans say about Biden and pushing back on their misinformation. You have to turn the volume up on this crazy stuff Trump says. And when we get it wrong, and we give them the opportunity to say, no, that wasn't, look how disingenuous you guys are, I think that that is like, I think that's an unforced error, and we shouldn't do it. The thing is, I do think we should call on the media to cover more. JVL's thing in the triad the other day about Mike Pence, where it's like the New York Times, like honest to God's, I think the thing was like, won't vote for Joe Biden. You know, Mike Pence won't vote for Trump or Joe Biden. Yeah. It's like, what insanity is this? Like, you're telling me you shouldn't have, every editorial should be, who's done a historical look back to figure out how vice presidents have treated former presidents, how historically anomalous this is. Anyway, I think we should be better.
The National Review did. There was a message from Dan McLaughlin about how about what would have happened if Andrew Johnson would have not endorsed Lincoln. Were we supposed to care about that? And it's like, well, part of the problem there is that Lincoln was the good one and Andrew Johnson was the bad one. So your counterfactual is inverted a little bit. Not quite the right counterfactual. But yeah, I hear you. Yeah, no, we all agree on that.
Can I ask a not very nice question? So we often...
Is it not nice to me or somebody else?
No, about human nature. Not nice about human nature. We often say on this show that the noise machine, the wave of bullshit, that it overwhelms people and it doesn't matter if it's wrong and if it gets corrected a day later, because the correction only hits like 5 people and the initial charge hits 100 people. What if that's true on this? I'm not saying more. This is what I'm saying. It's not a very nice question. I'm not saying that it justifies it. I'm not saying anything like that. But I'm asking purely as a nuts and bolts question. Is it possible that the bloodbath story actually does, you know, like 100 people hear the story and think it's bad but only five people hear the correction, and that the, you know, he's unfair. Because, you know what I'm saying? Like, we do think that the other way. Like, when it's about Biden, we think, like, everybody heard that they were trying to impeach him and the Hunter laptop from hell, but they didn't hear about the Russian guy who made it up.
Maybe that's true, but also it's wrong. Like,
it is wrong.
I don't know.
Yes.
I can't let go of this. And I saw a lot of this online, the sentiment of, like, why would you go to bat for Trump? Anything you do to go to bat for him.
Because you're a good person who goes to bat for the truth.
No. I'm not going back for Trump. I'm going back for, like, what I thought was the true thing.
Yes.
And also what I think is a deep distraction and a bad way for us to operate over the next 8 months. Because the narratives we want to drive home about Trump, it would be one thing. The reason they're making up shit about Biden is because they don't have real stuff to say about him.
Right.
That he's doing badly. With Trump, there is a problem with a fire hose of horrible stuff. And to glom onto and create headlines around one of the few things that wasn't actually what he was saying, to me seems like a big mistake.
Can I just throw in,
one's going to like this, and I understand
I think they should hear. I'm coming to Sarah's defense of this because it's interesting. This pairs very well with the Daily Pod that you haven't listened to yet because it's not up. They taped with Stephen Hayes with the Dispatch today, and his big complaint about Never Trumpers is that they, you know, shine Biden's turds too much. You know, rather than speaking truth.
My least favorite phrase is in the English language, but go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm pretty sure he used that phrase. I don't want to.
Well, strap it on, Sarah. Your football helmet. Sorry.
So I'll characterize what I said back to him, which is in line with what Sarah's saying here. Actually, over the course of the next 7 months, and I want our listeners that love Joe Biden to hear this the most clearly.
I'm listening, Tim.
The most helpful thing, JVL, that you can do for Joe Biden I'm interested in your view on this, to reach those focus group voters, the swing voters over the next 7 months, is to say, Joe Biden is losing a step probably. Like, he's getting old. He's made some mistakes. I don't love the resistance media's treatment of him all the time. I have other concerns. But by the way, he is a million times better than Donald Trump, even still, acknowledging all my concerns about him. And I'm going to support Joe Biden anyway. And to me, I feel like there's this sense that, like, oh, the best thing that you can do to help Joe Biden is to be a fanboy. And that's not really true, right? Like, the people that you're trying to get to are not Joe. They're the double haters. They're the epox on both their houses. So wouldn't you think, Sarah, that the way to get to them is to be like, yes, epox on his house. And also, it's way nicer than the fucking shanty down the street.
Yeah. Here's the thing. I think people should do what they think is true. If JVL loves Joe Biden and thinks that he's amazing and wants to fanboy about him, he should. Because somebody does need to tell, just from a purely utilitarian political standpoint, someone needs to tell positive stories about Joe Biden. And that's why I think it should be these Democratic surrogates that I'm always begging to get out there. For my role, and even, look, and I think that Joe Biden has actually done a number of things poorly. I think he's done a number of things actually very well. And so, like, I am fine with Joe Biden, especially on the foreign policy from the last, you know, year or two. He has been excellent. But I know from the campaign that we're running with Republican voters against Trump, listening to these people, that the thing that is going to move them and the thing that feels authentic to them, right? They say, I have never voted for a Democrat in my life. They say, I don't like Joe Biden. I disagree with Joe Biden. But, like, I cannot and will not vote for Donald Trump, and Joe Biden's fine. Like, or I'll live with it, or I'll hold my nose, whatever. That is authentic to how this election's going to be decided at the margins. So it depends who you're talking to. You want to tell a shiny story about Joe Biden? Go ahead. But, like, we're building an anti-Trump coalition, not a pro-Joe Biden.
Oh, really?
We're building an anti-Trump coalition.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's a good point.
And this is where the Steve Hayes, I don't know what he said, I can't wait to listen to this podcast, but, like, their editorial, the Dispatch's editorial that's like, let me tell you why Trump is bad and let me tell you why Joe Biden is bad and why, ugh, gosh, who can decide, makes me want to take my computer, throw it through a window, and then follow it out. And what it is it is, number one, they don't believe it. They don't believe it. They can do, every single one of these baseball crank types can do a threat assessment between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. And, like, it's not close. It's just not.
Okay, well, that's an agreement that we have.
Okay, Cassidy Hutchinson, go.
Donald Trump threatened to, once her prosecuted, because blah, 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 Tony Ornato lied to her, you know, supposedly the story that she told for the January 6th committee about how Trump wanted to go to the Capitol and lunged at the Secret Service person is not true. But like, not that the facts ever matter in Trump stories, but what Cassidy Hutchinson testified was that Tony Ornato told her that that's what happened, who's the former Secret Service person who became his security guy. And so really what we know is that the Tony Ornato lied once. He either lied to Cassidy Hutchinson to butch up Trump and make it seem like he wanted to go to the Capitol, or he's lying now to try to cover Trump's ass. So that's all we know is Tony Ornato's a liar. We know that for sure. But Trump now wants to take that and blame that lie on Cassidy Hutchinson and prosecute her based on his bleats. And the what is relevant here is obviously Cassidy Hutchinson is right and Trump is wrong. And something that Bill and I have been talking about is that just this incentive structure of a Trump 2.0 of saying, I am going to salute and pardon the January 6th rioters. I'm going to salute and pardon anybody that does what I want to do against the law. And I will prosecute anybody that speaks actual truth that whistleblows against me is maybe even probably less than leaving NATO, but like maybe the second most dangerous thing that he's definitely going to do, right? That is a mode of governance.
What he is doing is he's showing us how he's going to govern.
He is definitely going to go after the January 6th committee folks. Like he will try to make Liz Cheney, like he will try to halt, he will try to do, and this is the thing. Can I just back to on messaging about this? Donald Trump is telling us that he's running for retribution. Okay. And that is why he will make a circus out of prosecutions against people who prosecuted him. And I don't think it's not like a stretch. It's not like overheated. It's not tedious to say that's what he's going to do. He's telling us he's going to do it. We can see it, how it would happen. But this is why for Trump, you know, I was on Chris Wallace's like Saturday show with Kara Swisher last week and your buddy, John McCormick. No, why? It has a point. She had this like messaging advice where everything about Trump should be racist, rapist, fascist, like just over and over again, rapist, racist, fascist. And I disagree with that completely. The part that I do agree with, though, is the repetition of specific things that we want people to understand about Trump this time around and the way that you set a frame that then all the things he does layers into it. And so to me, the number one thing is that he is a lunatic who's going to be surrounded by other lunatics, right? Because voters understand the idea that, like, a president doesn't do everything themselves. And a lot of people's rationale for Trump the first time was, like, well, he'll be surrounded by good people. You know, yeah. Mattis will be there. The institutions will stand by. But it's not the case this time. He's talking about bringing back Manafort. He's talking about putting back Mike Flynn. Like, he is a lunatic who will be surrounded by other lunatics, people who tried to help him steal the election. Good people will not work for him. That's one thing. Then the other thing, though, that to me this seems about as simple and as straightforward, which is that Trump is running for himself. He's not running because he has some vision for the country or he has something he wants to do for people. The retribution that he seeks is for the people who've persecuted him. It is all about his grievances. It is not about the reason he like struck a nerve in 2016 is because he shared grievances with the voters. He's not doing that now. It's his grievance. And so the idea that he is running to stay out of jail and he is running to get people to give him money because he is now poor because he owes $500 million, that is something that voters understand about his motivation. And I think that focusing on those things, focusing on the January 6th, I'm not going to go back to the bloodbath thing. But I think the fact that he is going to be a lunatic surrounded by other lunatics and that he is running for himself.
What about loser? Does that fit into your view of it? I mention this only because when I was on the focus group with you, one of the things that jumped out to me was that the persuadable Trump voters all had in common they thought he lost. Yeah. And so is hammering the fact that he lost in 2020 a key to try to wedge people off? Or is that like too boutique? That's for targeted messaging.
No, I don't think it's boutique. I think that's fine. I think it's good. I think it's a broad thing. I don't know that it's as forward looking, right? Like you want it to be forward looking and about how it's going to impact the lives of people. And so the idea that he would be a lunatic surrounded by other lunatics who cannot be trusted with the government or anything like, you know, any of the important things the president does, and the fact that he has no interest in helping them with the things that they care about, to me seem about, that seems about voters and not just about like whether Trump's a, I mean, I do think there's a lot of wisdom in the idea that when we focus on like the dictator stuff or he's an autocrat, that tends to actually work in his favor a little bit on the strength, how much voters want strength in somebody. You hear it all the time. And I think that that sometimes plays into things we don't want it to.
All right. Good show. Insanely long show. We're going to...
We had a rant about Eileen Cannon. We didn't get to it. Do it as a JVL take. Let's do a JVL take for the YouTube feed.
No. That's for the secret show. Oh. Sarah, you and I on Friday morning are going to sit down and do secret show, and we're going to talk about my triad from today, in which
I've already read it
personally, literally, have the opportunity to help Donald Trump make his $500 million bond. I get a vote in whether or not I literally get a vote. You got to read the triad.
Trump's fate is in JVL's hands.
You got to read the triad to get the whole story. I'm not overselling it. It's amazing. And so maybe you'll have read it by Friday morning. Who could say?
Maybe. Who could say?
All right, guys. Great show. Long show. We'll do this again next week. See ya.